Lincoln, Disc 4.
Chapter 3. Cold, Calculating, Unimpassioned Reason. On April 15, 1837, Lincoln rode into Springfield on a borrowed horse, with all his worldly possessions crammed into two saddlebags. At the general store of A.Y. Ellison Company on the west side of the town square, he inquired how much a mattress for a single bed plus sheets and a pillow would cost. Joshua F. Speed, one of the proprietors, reckoned up the figures and announced a total of $17. Lincoln replied that was doubtless fair enough, but that he didn't have so much money, telling Speed that he'd come to Springfield to try an experiment as a lawyer. He asked for credit until Christmas, adding in a sad voice, "If I fail in this, I don't know that I can ever pay you." Speed, who knew this young man by reputation and had heard him make a political speech, suggested a way he could avoid incurring a debt that clearly troubled him. "I have a large room with a double bed upstairs, which you are very welcome to share with me," he offered. "Where's your room?" asked Lincoln. When Speed pointed to the winding stairs that led from the store to the second floor, Lincoln picked up his saddlebags and went up. Shortly afterward, he returned, beaming with pleasure, and announced, "Well, Speed, I'm moved." Such a quick alteration from deep despair to blithe confidence was characteristic of Lincoln's early years in the new state capital. He was trying to put together the fragmented pieces of his personality into a coherent pattern. Sometimes he felt he was the prisoner of his passions, but at other times he thought that he could master his world through reason. Often he was profoundly discouraged, and during these years he experienced his deepest bouts of depression. But these moods alternated with periods of exuberant self-confidence and almost annoying optimism. In short, he was still a very young man. To Eastern observers, Springfield in the 1830s was a frontier town. Though there were a few brick edifices, many of the residences were still log houses. If the roads were wide, they were unpaved. In the winter, wagons struggled through axle-deep mud, and in the summer the dust was suffocating. The town had no sidewalks, and at crossings, pedestrians had to leap from one chunk of wood to another. Hogs freely roamed the streets, and there was a powerful stench from manure piled outside the stables. After visiting Springfield, William Cullen Bryant came away with an impression of dirt and discomfort. But this was the most cosmopolitan and sophisticated place Lincoln had ever lived. Though Springfield had been in existence only since 1821, it was now a thriving community with 1,500 residents. The Sangamon County Courthouse occupied the center of town, which was laid out in a regular rectangular grid. The north-south streets were numbered. Those running east and west were named after American presidents. The courthouse, soon to be replaced by the new state capitol, was surrounded by 19 dry goods stores, 7 groceries, 4 drug stores, 2 clothing stores, and a bookstore. 4 hotels cared for transients. In addition to schools and an academy, roughly equivalent to a high school, the town boasted 6 churches. The professions were represented by 18 doctors and 11 lawyers. There was a Whig newspaper, the Sangamo Journal, edited by Simeon Francis, to whom Lincoln, during the previous sessions of the legislature, had frequently sent news from Vandalia, and it would shortly be joined by the Democratic organ, the Illinois Republican, later rechristened the Illinois State Register. Lincoln had every intention of becoming a part of this bustling community. But in addition to a lack of education and money, he had a handicap. He was, in a sense, engaged. After the death of Anne Rutledge, the older women of New Salem urged him to find a wife, as most of the other young men his age were doing. But there weren't many eligible young women in the vicinity, and anyway, he was always awkward in their presence. He had, however, taken a liking to a sister of Mrs. Bennet Able, who visited New Salem in 1833 or 1834. The daughter of a well-to-do Kentucky family, Mary Owens was a handsome young woman with black hair, dark eyes, fair skin, and magnificent white teeth. She impressed everyone with her gay and lively disposition, and the residents of the village considered her a very intellectual woman, well-educated. After she returned to Kentucky, Lincoln is said to have boasted to Mrs. Able that, "If ever that girl comes back to New Salem, I'm going to marry her." On her second visit, about a year after the death of Anne Rutledge, Lincoln began courting Mary Owens. And at first she reciprocated his interest. Then both began to have second thoughts. Granting Lincoln's goodness of heart, Mary felt that his training had been different from mine, hence there was not that congeniality which would otherwise have existed. Small events pointed to future difficulties. When she and Lincoln went for a walk with Mrs. Bowling Green, who was struggling to carry a very fat baby, he made no attempt to help her. On another occasion, when several young people were riding horseback to the Greens, she observed that all the other young women were assisted by their escorts in crossing a deep stream, while Lincoln rode ahead, paying her no attention. When she mentioned the neglect to him, he replied oafishly that he reckoned she could take care of herself. Soon she concluded that Mr. Lincoln was deficient in those little links which make up the chain of woman's happiness. Lincoln's doubts were even more severe. Maybe Mary'd been a little too eager to return to New Salem. He feared that her coming so readily showed that she was a trifle too willing. He began finding defects in her appearance. From her first visit, he remembered that she was pleasingly stout, weighing between 150 and 180 pounds, according to contemporaries, but now she appeared a fair match for Falstaff. In a burlesque account of the affair, written a few months later, he declared, "Now, when I beheld her, I couldn't for my life avoid thinking of my mother, and this not from withered features, for her skin was too full of fat to permit its contracting into wrinkles, but from her want of teeth, weather-beaten appearance in general, and from a kind of notion that ran in my head that nothing could have commenced at the size of infancy and reached her present bulk in less than 35 or 40 years. His reservations were rationalizations. Painfully aware of his humble origins, he wasn't sure that he could make this well-bred young woman happy, and he was too poor to support a wife in comfort. On a deeper level, the problem was that his personality was as yet so incompletely formed that he had great difficulty in reaching out to achieve intimacy with anyone else. When Lincoln went to Vandalia in December 1836, he and Mary hadn't reached any positive understanding, but both felt their informal arrangement might lead to marriage. For the next 6 months, he engaged in an undignified attempt to get out of the liaison without injuring the lady's feelings or violating his sense of honor. Betraying no passion whatever, and never mentioning the word love, his letters to her were, as he admitted, so dry and stupid that he was reluctant to send them. His main purpose in writing was to get Mary to take the initiative in breaking off the courtship. After he moved to Springfield, he grew more than ever convinced that she didn't fit in. "She'd be unhappy," he warned. "There's a great deal of flourishing about in carriages here, which it'd be your doom to see without sharing it," he cautioned. "You'd have to be poor without the means of hiding your poverty." "You haven't been accustomed to hardship," he reminded her, "and it may be more severe than you now imagine." Apparently, neither Lincoln's letters nor the arguments he made when he revisited New Salem in the summer of 1837 convinced Mary that they were incompatible. He began to take a different tack, suggesting that it was for her emotional as well as her physical well-being that she should break off their relationship. "I want in all cases to do right, and most particularly so in all cases with women," he told her, and he was convinced that it would be best for Mary if he left her alone. "For the purpose of making the matter as plain as possible," he wrote her, "I now say that you can now drop the subject of marriage, dismiss your thoughts, if you ever had any, from me forever, and leave this letter unanswered, without calling forth one accusing murmur from me. Indeed, if so doing would add to her peace of mind, it's my sincere wish that you should." Then, having done his best to persuade her to break their understanding, he manfully announced, "I am willing and even anxious to bind you faster, if I can be convinced that it will in any considerable degree add to your happiness." If Mary wrote a reply to this left-handed proposal, it hasn't been preserved. But Lincoln recorded that she firmly and repeatedly refused his tepid offer of marriage. To his surprise, instead of being relieved, he felt mortified almost beyond endurance. "My vanity was deeply wounded that she, whom I'd taught myself to believe nobody else would have, had actually rejected me with all my fancied greatness," he reported some months later. Once it was certain that Mary didn't return his affections, he even began to suspect that he was really a little in love with her. Immensely relieved that the whole affair was over, he wrote a farcical account of his failed courtship, carefully not mentioning Mary Owens by name, to amuse Mrs. O. H. Browning, which ended, "I have now come to the conclusion never again to think of marrying, and for this reason, I can never be satisfied with anyone who would be blockhead enough to have me." "This thing of living in Springfield is rather a dull business after all. At least it is so to me," Lincoln lamented to Mary Owens a month after he had moved from New Salem. "I am quite as lonesome here as I ever was anywhere in my life." No doubt he did feel isolated during his first few weeks in town, but he was probably exaggerating his feelings to discourage Mary from further thinking about marriage. Indeed, he was presently surrounded by friends and welcomed in Springfield society. From the beginning, Speed was his close companion, and he became perhaps the only intimate friend that Lincoln ever had. 4 years younger than Lincoln, Speed was also a Kentuckian. Unlike Lincoln, though, Speed came from a prominent family that owned a prosperous plantation called Farmington, near Louisville, tilled by 70 slaves. Speed had attended private schools in Kentucky and had studied for 2 years at St. Joseph's College in Bardstown. Seeking to make his fortune, he came to Springfield and became a part proprietor of Ellis's store. With flashing blue eyes and a mane of dark curly hair, he was a handsome young man, whose vaguely Byronic air of elegance made him especially attractive to Springfield ladies. For nearly 4 years, Lincoln and Speed shared a double bed, and their most private thoughts, in the room above Speed's store. No one thought that there was anything irregular or unusual about the arrangement. It was rare for a single man to have a private room, and it was customary for two or more to sleep in the same bed. Years later, when Lincoln was a well-known lawyer, he and the other attorneys traveling the judicial circuit regularly shared beds. Only Judge David Davis was allowed to sleep alone, not because of his dignified position, but because he weighed over 300 pounds. Much of the time, when Lincoln and Speed were sharing a bed, young William H. Herndon, who'd recently been withdrawn from Illinois College in Jacksonville and was clerking in Speed's store, slept in the same room, as did Charles R. Hurst, a clerk in another dry goods store. Around Lincoln and Speed gathered the other young unmarried men of Springfield, like James H. Matheny, who would become the best man at Lincoln's wedding, Milton Hay, then a law student and clerk in the Stewart and Lincoln office, and James C. Conkling, a Princeton graduate who began practicing law in Springfield in 1838. Before the great fireplace in the back room of Speed's store, they met night after night to talk and swap stories, and Lincoln, with his endless repertoire of anecdotes, was always the center of the group. Acting as an informal literary and debating society, the young men read each other's poems and other writings, and, as Herndon recalled, they staged debates on politics, religion, and all other subjects. Lincoln quickly made other friends in town. William Butler, clerk of the Sangamon County Court, greatly liked this unusual young man who had just moved in from the country, and, knowing that he was hard up, generously gave him free board at his house. Simeon Francis welcomed Lincoln to Springfield and opened the columns of the Sangamo Journal for anything he might care to write. And John Todd Stewart introduced his new partner to the more exclusive social circles of Springfield. Lincoln found easy acceptance in Springfield because he arrived not as an unknown, but as the partner of Stewart, one of the most prominent and successful lawyers in town. Unlike most beginning lawyers, who had to hunt around for business or accept cases that no one else would take, Lincoln began with a very full practice. For Stewart was concentrating on winning a seat in the United States House of Representatives and turned over most of the business of the firm to his junior partner. Their office was a single room on the second floor, in a group of brick buildings on Fifth Street known as Huffman's Row, just a block north of the courthouse square. As Herndon remembered, it was furnished only with a small lounge or bed, a chair containing a buffalo robe, in which the junior member was wont to sit and study, a hard wooden bench, a feeble attempt at a bookcase, and a table which answered for a desk. Here Lincoln and Stewart received clients, heard their complaints, and advised what, if any, action was appropriate. If there was a question of legal precedence, the partners could consult their library, which consisted of a couple of volumes of Illinois reports and some miscellaneous congressional documents, legislative proceedings, and law books. It was a meager resource, but at this time probably no law library in Springfield contained as many as 100 books. Lincoln had no difficulty in performing the routine work of the office, like drafting wills or writing deeds. He'd done a certain amount of this for his neighbors in New Salem, even before he was admitted to the bar. Many of the Stewart and Lincoln cases involved only an appearance before a justice of the peace, few of whom were lawyers. Thus, when Joel Johnson accused John Gray of forcible detainer, Stewart and Lincoln represented him at Justice Clement's hearing. Lincoln was thoroughly acquainted with these procedures, since he'd regularly attended Bowling Green's court in New Salem. More complex cases went to trial before the circuit court, where, again, Lincoln had some experience as an observer and as a witness. Indeed, his familiarity with the process, as well as his expertise as a surveyor, had caused the circuit court in Morgan County, Jacksonville, to use him even before he was admitted to the bar as what might be called a paralegal in a disputed case over land and timber. But now, as a licensed attorney, usually operating without his partner or other associates, he had a much greater responsibility fully to master the forms and procedures of litigation. For even a minor technical error could cause his client to lose his case. In bringing a case before the circuit court, a lawyer had first to decide whether to plead it in law or in chancery. The first referred to a highly formal set of proceedings and precedents derived from British common law, while the second, sometimes called equity proceedings, followed somewhat more flexible and discretionary rules. In either case, the attorney, and for clarity it will be assumed that he was representing the plaintiff, must first draft a precipe, a brief request to the clerk of the court to issue a summons to the defendant. The precipe included a brief statement of the nature of the controversy and the amount of damages alleged. The plaintiff's lawyer then drafted what was called a declaration, indicating the form of action under which the suit was brought and setting forth the facts of the case. In common law, there were 11 major forms of action: trespass, trespass on the case, replevin, assumpsit, ejectment, etc., each of which applied to different kinds of suits. An action for trespass, for example, rose when a plaintiff alleged that his person had been interfered with by assault or battery, or that his land or property had been damaged. But an action for trespass on the case involved indirect or accidental damage, or damage to intangible property. Thus, a man who claimed a neighbor had stolen his cow would bring an action for trespass, while one who asserted that he'd been slandered by his neighbor would bring one for trespass on the case. The lawyer who incorrectly identified the action he was bringing might have his case thrown out of court. The declaration also included a full account of the plaintiff's version of the facts in the case. This had to be prepared with the utmost care. If it alleged facts that couldn't be proved in a trial, the plaintiff could lose even if those facts weren't necessary to sustain his case. If it alleged facts that differed from those presented at a trial, his case could be thrown out. In one 1859 decision, a case was dismissed because the amount of a promissory note stated in the declaration differed by half a cent from the amount of the note as proved in the trial. In his early cases, Lincoln paid close attention to one of the form books that suggested the proper language for declarations. And in his desire to avoid all technical errors, his documents often grew excessively legalistic and wordy. For instance, in a May 1838 case in Fulton County for the collection of an unpaid note, his declaration alleged, "For that whereas the said defendants by and under the name, style, and firm of John W. Shinn and Company, heretofore, to wit, on the 23rd day of March in the year of our Lord 1836 at Philadelphia, to wit, at the county and state aforesaid, made their certain promissory note, in writing, bearing date, the date and year aforesaid, and thereby then and there promised to pay, 12 months after the date thereof, the said plaintiffs, in their partnership name of Atwood and Company, the sum of $762.36 for value received, and there and then delivered the said promissory note to the said plaintiffs." As he became more experienced, he pared the legalisms and redundancies, and his declarations became models of simplicity and clarity. After Lincoln filed his declaration with the clerk of the Sangamon County Circuit Court, the lawyer for the defendant would come back with a demurrer, alleging that the plaintiff's allegations were defective as a matter of law, or a traverse, stating his client's version of the disputed facts or events. Lincoln, for the plaintiff, might respond with a replication, taking exception to that counterstatement, and the opposing attorney could submit a rejoinder. All these papers, which might run to many pages, had to be written out in longhand. There were no secretaries and no copying machines. Fortunately, most of the early cases in which Lincoln was engaged required more common sense than mastery of precedents. They concerned such matters as a suit by Speed, on behalf of A.Y. Ellis and Company, for payment of a debt to the store by one Thomas P. Smith. In a slightly more complicated case, Lincoln represented Elijah Houghton, who'd been swapping some of his land with David Hart for 12 acres or so along Rock Creek near New Salem, land that Lincoln himself had surveyed. The death of Hart put their handshake deal into question, and Houghton now asked the court to require Hart's 3 children and heirs to live up to the terms of the agreement. From the beginning, Stuart and Lincoln carried a heavy load of such cases. As early as the July 1837 term of the Sangamon County Circuit Court, the partners had 19 common law cases and 7 chancery cases on the docket, more than twice as many as their closest rivals, Logan and Baker, and far more than any other attorneys. In the following terms, Logan and Baker once exceeded the caseload of Stuart and Lincoln, and from time to time, especially as Stuart prepared to take his seat in Congress, Samuel H. Treat also surpassed them. But always Lincoln had as much business as he could handle. Lincoln's legal practice wasn't confined to Sangamon County. No lawyer could make his living from the 2 two-week terms that the circuit court met in Springfield each year, and Lincoln, like most other attorneys, traveled on the huge circuit that the judges were obliged to make, going from one county seat to another and holding sessions that lasted from 2 days to a week. Lincoln appeared at Bloomington in McLean County as early as 1837, and the following year he began regularly to attend the courts of Tazewell, Macon, Morgan, and other central Illinois counties. A full schedule didn't mean full pockets. Springfield was a town full of lawyers, and all were obliged to charge modest fees. For most of the cases Stewart and Lincoln handled, the fee was $5, and the ordinary range was from $2.50 to $10. In one case, the partners charged $50, a fee so high that the client apparently asked to pay some of it by making a coat for Stewart worth $15. In another, where the partners represented a Springfield hotel keeper, the client paid their fee by giving Lincoln board for $6. It was Lincoln's job, as junior partner, to record these fees, which he and Stewart split equally. He was also supposed to keep a record of the firm's income in a fee book, where he listed cases, the disposition, and the fees charged. Here, too, he entered expenses, such as for several loads of wood, which he apparently cut up with the $2.25 wood saw he purchased, and for an $8.50 stovepipe. For a time he was conscientious in keeping records, but presently the task became onerous and long gaps began to appear. Neither Stewart nor Lincoln was systematic, and the firm's papers were deposited in drawers, in pockets, and, especially, in Lincoln's stovepipe hat. From time to time, the partners had to apologize to clients for loss of papers or neglect of business. On one occasion, after Stewart left for Washington, Lincoln had to ask his partner how to silence one client who's teasing me continually about some deeds which he says he left with you, but which I can find nothing of, and how to answer a damned hawk-billed Yankee who was besetting him about a claim that hadn't been settled. Despite careless bookkeeping, the firm was a successful one, and it afforded Lincoln a remarkable opportunity to begin his career at the bar. He quickly discovered that his brief and unsystematic training made him the match for other self-taught lawyers, and even for those who'd studied, usually without much direction, in the office of some older attorney. After Stewart left to serve in Congress, Lincoln had no doubts about his ability to run the firm in his partner's absence, and he marked the new era in the fee book, Commencement of Lincoln's Administration, 1839, November 2nd. Much of the time, during these early years, Lincoln seemed to think of his legal career as an adjunct to his political aspirations. He'd hardly settled in Springfield before he took on a case that became the occasion of assailing his political opponents. In May 1837, Mrs. Mary Anderson, together with her son Richard, engaged Stewart and Lincoln on a contingent fee to recover 10 acres of land lying just north of Springfield, later to become the site of the Oak Ridge Cemetery. The tract was held by James Adams, a prominent Democratic officeholder in Springfield, but Mrs. Anderson claimed it was part of the estate of her recently deceased husband. On looking into the records, Lincoln became convinced that Adams's deed to the land was fraudulent, and that Mrs. Anderson's claim was valid. Enlisting Stephen T. Logan, one of the ablest and most experienced lawyers in Springfield, as fellow counsel, he brought suit in the Sangamon County Circuit Court. Up to that point, his conduct was entirely professional. But soon his bitter political animus against Adams began to show. Adams was, in fact, a man with a shady past, who'd fled New York rather than face charges that he'd forged a deed to 600 acres. But what angered Lincoln was Adams's candidacy for the lucrative office of Judge of the Probate Court, for which Dr. Anson G. Henry, a Whig and a special friend of Lincoln's, was also running. While the court case against Adams was pending, Lincoln and his fellow lawyers began to try it in the newspapers. In 6 letters, signed Sampson's Ghost, which they published weekly in the Sangamo Journal, they attacked Adams as a Tory and a supporter of the Hartford Convention, called on him to explain to the citizens of this county by what authority he holds possession of 2 lots of ground in Springfield, upon which he now resides, and hinted that Adams's title to the Anderson land was also fraudulent. Throughout the summer and fall of 1837, Springfield papers were filled with these charges against Adams, and with countercharges by Adams and his friends. Though Lincoln may not have written all the Sampson's Ghost letters, Adams correctly identified him as his primary enemy and struck back with public letters that challenged his facts and his logic. Seeking to take advantage of Lincoln's unconventional religious views, Adams labeled him a deist. Lincoln responded in a handbill, followed by 2 public letters, which tried to discredit Adams's witnesses and ridiculed his efforts to tear, rend, split, rive, blow up, confound, overwhelm, annihilate, extinguish, exterminate, burst asunder, and grind to powder all his slanderers. The unedifying and unprofessional controversy lost much of its point when Sangamon County voters in the fall election showed how little credence they gave to Lincoln's allegations by defeating Henry and electing Adams probate judge. The suit over the Anderson property, together with other related actions, dragged on for several years. But Adams remained in possession of the land at his death in 1843. Lincoln exhibited the same fierce partisanship in the state legislature, which continued to meet in Vandalia pending the completion of the new state capitol in Springfield. Now one of the more experienced members, he was twice the unsuccessful candidate of the Whigs for Speaker of the House of Representatives. In the 1838-39 session, he served on no fewer than 14 committees, including the influential Finance Committee. But much of his work was done behind the scenes in organizing and managing the Whig minority. On the floor of the House, he participated in the debates more easily and freely, occasionally lightening the proceedings with a bit of levity. When a representative from Montgomery County expressed fear about the mounting debts and deficits caused by the Internal Improvements Plan, Lincoln said he was reminded of an eccentric Hoosier bachelor, very famous for seeing big bugaboos in everything, who went hunting and fired his gun repeatedly at a squirrel which he claimed was at the top of a tree. Unable to see anything in the tree, his brother examined the hunter's person carefully and found on one of his eyelashes a big louse crawling about. "It's so with the gentleman from Montgomery," Lincoln joked. "He imagined he could see squirrels every day when they were nothing but lice." Lincoln's main objective in the legislature was to protect Springfield. He introduced legislation to incorporate Springfield as a town and to secure state funds for the completion of the new statehouse. Until the actual removal of the state government in 1839, supporters of Vandalia made repeated efforts to repeal the legislation making Springfield the capital. In the 1837 session, for example, General W.L.D. Ewing, who represented Vandalia in the legislature, denounced the arrogance of Springfield, its presumption in claiming the seat of government, and charged the legislation removing the capital had been obtained by chicanery and trickery. chosen by the Sangamon delegation to respond, Lincoln struck back with such severity that observers expected Ewing to challenge him to a duel. Closely related to Lincoln's defense of Springfield's interests was his position on the ambitious Internal Improvements Plan, which had foundered after the Panic of 1837. In view of falling revenues and the collapse of the market for Illinois bonds, most leaders of both parties favored curtailing or abandoning the scheme to crisscross the state with railroads and canals, but not Lincoln. Admitting that Sangamon County have received great and important benefits in return for giving support through her delegation to the system of internal improvement, he announced that the county was morally bound, though not legally bound, to support that system. To those who wanted to modify the scheme, he said the legislature had gone too far to recede, even if we were disposed to do so. "We are," he added, "now so far advanced in a general system of internal improvements that, if we would, we can't retreat from it without disgrace and great loss." Something more than face-saving lay behind Lincoln's support of internal improvements. He continued to think of America as buoyant and prosperous, a land of opportunity where poor boys like himself could get ahead. He had no doubt of the rich resources of Illinois, which, he said, surpasses every other spot of equal extent upon the face of the globe in fertility of soil, and was therefore capable of sustaining a greater amount of agricultural wealth and population than any other equal extent of territory in the world. Railroads and canals were desperately needed to bring the state's produce to the world's markets. It was a terrible misfortune that the panic had occurred when the Internal Improvements Plan was getting underway, just at the time when the largest investment was required, and the least return could be expected. Consequently, the state found itself at a point which may aptly be likened to the dead point in a steam engine, a point extremely difficult of turning. But he was confident that, once turned, it would present no further difficulty, and all again will be well. Using a different metaphor, he argued that stopping support of these projects now would be very much like stopping a skiff in the middle of a river. If it was not going up, it would go down. Acknowledging his share of the responsibility devolving upon us in the present crisis, Lincoln looked for alternative ways to finance the building of roads and canals. For a time, he placed much hope in a plan similar to one he'd advanced earlier for Illinois to purchase from the federal government all publicly owned lands in the state for $5 million. Profits from the sale of these lands to actual settlers would more than pay the cost of internal improvements, he argued. The legislature agreed to make the offer to Washington, but nothing came of it. Reluctantly, he turned to taxation and favored a graduated levy on land, which had hitherto been taxed at a flat rate. Believing the change to be equitable within itself, he reminded legislators that the increased levy would fall on the wealthy few who, it is still to be remembered, are not sufficiently numerous to carry the elections. As the economy continued to deteriorate, Lincoln sought to retrieve something from the general wreck of the internal improvement scheme by continuing to fund at least one work calculated to yield something towards defraying its expense. But, as he anticipated, his colleagues allowed the internal improvement system to be put down in a lump. Lincoln's pertinacity in defending the internal improvement system was equaled only by the vigor of his support for the State Bank of Illinois. Like most Whigs, he preferred a strong national bank. After Andrew Jackson destroyed the power of the Bank of the United States, Lincoln gave his allegiance to the State Bank, and particularly to its central branch in Springfield, which had been created during his first term in the legislature. Again and again he voted to defeat Democratic proposals for investigating the bank, and in 1839, when the Democratic majority succeeded in authorizing a committee to look into the bank's affairs, Lincoln made sure that he was one of the members. He attended the meetings of the committee with fair regularity, despite the heavy calls on his time for other legislative business, and he saw to it that the long report of the investigation attributed the bank's suspension of specie payments not to any organic defects of the institutions themselves, but to the irresistible law of trade and exchange, which can't be controlled by country banks. The fate of the bank remained in doubt, as Democrats, opposed to all banks on principle, and especially hostile to this Whiggish bank in Springfield, mounted campaign after campaign for its destruction. At times, even Lincoln gave up on saving it, lamenting that the legislature was allowing the bank to forfeit its charter, and that there was but very little disposition to resuscitate it. Nevertheless, he persisted, and in December 1840, he demonstrated the extent of his devotion to the bank in an episode that became celebrated as what he called that jumping scrape. The bank had been authorized to continue its suspension of specie payments only until the end of the legislative session, which was scheduled for the first week in December. Knowing that the bank would immediately be bankrupt if forced to pay out specie, Lincoln and his fellow Whigs hoped to prevent the adjournment of the legislature, now holding its first session in the newly completed Capitol at Springfield. Of course, Democrats who wanted to kill the bank favored adjournment. The only way the Whigs could keep the legislature in session was by absenting themselves, so that there was no quorum. They left Lincoln, together with one or two of his trusted lieutenants, to watch the proceedings, and to demand roll calls when the Democrats tried to adjourn. The session dragged on into the evening, and candles had to be brought in. Several Democrats rose from their sick beds to help form a quorum. Rattled, Lincoln and his aides lost their heads and voted on the next roll call. Then, still hoping to block adjournment, they unsuccessfully tried to get out of the locked door. When the sergeant-at-arms rebuffed them, they jumped out the first-story window. Their effort was in vain, because the speaker recorded them as present and voting, and with the quorum assured, the House adjourned and the bank was killed. The whole affair became the subject of much amusement among the Democrats, who ridiculed Mr. Lincoln and his flying brethren, and noted that his celebrated leap caused him no harm because his legs reached nearly from the window to the ground. Disliking to appear ridiculous, Lincoln allowed his affection for the bank to cool, and when the subject was introduced again the next year, he was noticeably less active in its defense. After one particularly sharp debate with John A. McClernand and other Democrats, who were, he said, trying to crush the bank, while he was trying to save both it and the state, he wearily announced that he was tired of this business. If there was to be this continual warfare against the institutions of the state, he went on, the sooner it was brought to an end, the better. In addition to serving as the leader of the Whigs in the state legislature, Lincoln labored indefatigably to organize his party, and he became one of the best-known Whig leaders, not merely in Springfield, but in central Illinois. In 1838, combining politics with his legal business at all the county courthouses where he practiced, he solicited votes for Stuart, who was running for a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives. Lincoln exhibited special enthusiasm in his partner's behalf because the Democratic opponent was Stephen A. Douglas, whom he'd already begun to consider his main political rival. Repeatedly, Lincoln urged his friends to be vigilant. "If we do our duty, we shall succeed in the congressional election, but if we relax an iota, we shall be beaten." Elected by a plurality of only 36 votes, Stuart faced a likely challenge to his credentials from Douglas, but Lincoln, along with other Springfield Whigs, mounted a counteroffensive designed to show that Douglas had received votes from unnaturalized foreigners, minors, and persons who hadn't resided in the state for the required 6 months. Shortly afterward, Lincoln was able to report to Stuart with some glee that the Democrats would probably drop the challenge, though, he added, "You know that if we'd heard Douglas say that he'd abandoned the contest, it wouldn't be very authentic." Eager for victory, Lincoln readily acquiesced when the Whigs deserted Henry Clay, one of the founders of the party, and nominated William Henry Harrison, the hero of the Battle of Tippecanoe, to run against Martin Van Buren in 1840. Thinking the chance of carrying the state very good, he began systematically organizing the Whigs of central Illinois. When a Democratic editor sneeringly referred to Harrison as a simple old man who wanted nothing better than to live in a log cabin and drink hard cider, Whigs capitalized on his blunder. His charge proved their candidate, in contrast to the aristocratic Van Buren, was a man of the people. Lincoln was afraid his party's rollicking populist campaign might not translate into votes. By this time, his earlier aversion to nominating conventions and the other machinery of party organization, which he shared with most Whigs, had disappeared. He explained that the Democrats, by recruiting their double-drilled army of supporters, had set us the example of organization, and we, in self-defense, are driven into it. He now drew up a semi-military plan for getting out the Whig votes. In order to bring about the overthrow of the corrupt powers that now control our beloved country, he urged the appointment of county, precinct, and section captains to make sure that every Whig can be brought to the polls in the coming presidential contest. Lincoln also did his part in bringing the issues before the people. An assiduous reader of the newspapers and a careful student of the Congressional Globe, which published in full the interminable debates in the national legislature, he was thoroughly prepared to defend Whig economic policies. In the almost nightly meetings around the fireplace at the back of Speed's store, where he and other young Springfield politicians argued these questions, he'd sharpened his debating skills. His opportunity to use them came when the discussion became heated one night and Douglas, now chairman of the Democratic State Committee, challenged his Whig opponents to a full-scale public discussion of the issues in the campaign. Lincoln willingly accepted. The first round of debate, on November 19, 1839, attracted much attention. Douglas, John Calhoun, the county surveyor who had once employed Lincoln, and two other Democrats opposed four leading Whigs, Edward D. Baker, the attorney who'd made a name for himself in his oration at the laying of the cornerstone of the new Capitol, Logan, Browning, and Lincoln. Most observers thought the contest a draw, but Lincoln felt he hadn't come up to the expectations of his friends. He was conscious of his failure, Joseph Gillespie reported, and I never saw any man so much distressed. He begged for another chance and challenged the Democrats to a return engagement in December. By the time Lincoln had his turn, on the day after Christmas, attendance was so embarrassingly small as to cast a damp upon his spirits. Nevertheless, he proceeded to deliver a carefully written address that, Gillespie recalled, transcended our highest expectations. His basic theme was the merits of a national bank, as contrasted to the independent treasury system of federal depositories, independent both of state banks and private business, which the Democrats favored. Inevitably, it contained a certain amount of rodomontade, such as a jeer at Douglas's stupid belief that his groundless and audacious assertions could go unchallenged, and a sneer that hundreds of Democratic office holders were scampering away with the public money to Texas, to Europe, and to every spot on the earth where a villain may hope to find refuge from justice. But for the most part, it was a sober, reasoned defense of the economic stability provided by a national bank, and a prediction of the adverse effects of the Democrats' sub-treasury plan. Lincoln took pains to keep his arguments down to earth. Not content with generalizing that the independent treasury would bring about distress, ruin, bankruptcy, and beggary, he brought the issue home by showing that, if it was established, the man who now raises money sufficient to purchase 80 acres will then raise but sufficient to purchase 40, or perhaps not that much. This address, published in full in the Sangamo Journal, and also as a pamphlet, contained little that was new, but it showed that Lincoln had now mastered the standard Whig arguments on economic issues. It served as his basic text throughout the 1840 presidential campaign. Wherever his law practice took him, or wherever he was invited, he made political speeches at Jacksonville, Carlinville, Alton, Belleville, Tremont, Waterloo, Mount Vernon, Carmi, Shawneetown, and Equality. Sometimes he made solo appearances, but as often he engaged in debates with Democratic leaders, especially Douglas. In these speeches, Lincoln at times indulged in the usual political rhetoric, demagogically attacking Van Buren for supporting the right of free blacks in New York to vote, and offering what Whig papers called a successful vindication of the civil and military reputation of the hero of Tippecanoe. Remarkably, though, at a time when many Whigs were carefully avoiding all discussion of issues in favor of a mindless log cabin and hard cider campaign, Lincoln spent most of his time on the stump soberly discussing Whig economic policies. That course should have come as no surprise to those who'd carefully followed Lincoln's career since his arrival in Springfield. As early as January 1838, in an address to the Young Men's Lyceum entitled "The Perpetuation of Our Political Institutions," he'd attacked hyper-emotionalism in politics, warning that the nation's proud fabric of freedom was endangered by the passions of the people, the jealousy, envy, and avarice incident to our nature. His central theme was the threat posed by social disorder. His topic was a conventional one for these lyceum meetings, where aspiring young men of the town tested their rhetorical skill and improved their elocution before their peers. But Lincoln developed it in a highly personal way. Like many of his contemporaries, Lincoln was troubled by what he perceived as the rapid rate change in American life. Canals and railroads were bringing about a transportation revolution. The population was swiftly spreading across the continent. Immigration was beginning to seem a threat to American social cohesion. Sectionalism was becoming ever more divisive. As the controversy over slavery mounted, the political battles of the Jackson era had destroyed the national political consensus. Most disturbing of all were the outbreaks of mob violence, which pervaded the country from New England to Louisiana. Two particular incidents Lincoln called to the attention of his audience: a vigilante outbreak in Mississippi, which began with the execution of gamblers, but continued until dead men were seen literally dangling from the boughs of trees upon every roadside, and in numbers almost sufficient to rival the native Spanish moss; and the burning to death in St. Louis of a mulatto man named McIntosh, accused of murdering a prominent citizen. If persons and property are held by no better tenure than the caprice of a mob, if the laws be continually despised and disregarded, Lincoln warned, citizens' affection for their government must inevitably be alienated. As a remedy, Lincoln urged what he called a simple solution. Let every American, every lover of liberty, every well-wisher to his posterity, swear by the blood of the Revolution never to violate in the least particular the laws of the country, and never to tolerate their violation by others. Let reverence for the laws be breathed by every American mother to the lisping babe that prattles on her lap. Let it be taught in schools, in seminaries, and in colleges. Let it be written in primers, spelling books, and in almanacs. Let it be preached from the pulpit, proclaimed in legislative halls, and enforced in courts of justice. In short, he urged, let it become the political religion of the nation. This was, for the most part, standard Whig rhetoric, of a piece with Lincoln's speech in the legislature the previous year, defending the state bank against the lawless and mobocratic spirit abroad in the land. But at this point in the Lyceum lecture, when most listeners must have thought he'd nearly finished, Lincoln, in effect, began again, asking why the danger to American political institutions was so much greater now than it had been for the past 50 years. In the first half of the lecture, he'd offered essentially a sociological interpretation of the danger. Now he offered a psychological explanation. In previous generations, he suggested, when the outcome of the American venture in self-government was still in doubt, all that sought celebrity and fame and distinction expected to find them in the success of that experiment. Even now there were many great and good men who aspired to nothing beyond a seat in Congress, a gubernatorial or presidential chair. But, he added, in a rare moment of self-revelation, such belong not to the family of the lion or the tribe of the eagle. Such honors were not enough for men of ambition and talents. These routine offices wouldn't satisfy an Alexander, a Caesar, or a Napoleon, from whom the greatest danger to popular government must be expected. Towering genius disdains a beaten path, Lincoln reminded his audience. It seeks regions hitherto unexplored. It thirsts and burns for distinction, and, if possible, it will have it. whether at the expense of emancipating slaves or enslaving freemen. Probably most of Lincoln's listeners thought this nothing more than another rhetorical flourish at the end of a long speech. Few could have realized that he was unconsciously describing himself. His ambition was no secret. As Herndon said, it was a little engine that knew no rest. But only Speed understood how avid was his thirst for distinction. To this one intimate friend, Lincoln confessed his ambition to link his name with something that would redound to the interest of his fellow man. And in his darker moods, he lamented that he'd done nothing to make any human being remember that he'd lived. It was to guard against men of ambition and talents, like himself, that Lincoln urged a second and fundamentally different way to preserve American political institutions. In the first half of his speech, he'd used conventional conservative rhetoric to favor the slow, organic growth of national feeling. Now he proposed erecting a new Temple of Liberty, not resting on emotion and custom, but carved from the solid quarry of sober reason. That invocation of reason accounted for one otherwise inexplicable omission from his Lyceum address. His failure to mention the one instance of mob violence closest to Springfield and most familiar to his listeners. In November 1837, a mob at Alton, Illinois, had killed Elijah P. Lovejoy, editor of the abolitionist paper The Observer. The Maine-born minister, who dedicated his paper to a war on slavery, intemperance, and popery, had been driven out of Missouri by the pro-slavery elements and the enraged Catholics of St. Louis, and he renewed his campaign from Alton, 25 miles up the Mississippi River on the Illinois side. Breaking his repeated pledges to edit his paper in the interests of the Presbyterian Church alone, Lovejoy became increasingly strident in his abolitionism. Irate residents of Alton, tied by kinship and trade to the South, twice threw his printing presses into the river. When he and 60 young armed abolitionists from towns nearby vowed to defend a third press, the mob burned the warehouse where the press was stored and shot Lovejoy. This brutal infringement of the freedom of the press sent a shockwave through the North and provoked protest meetings in all the major cities. But when Lincoln spoke out against mob violence, he didn't mention Lovejoy or Alton by name and offered only a passing condemnation of persons who, among other outrages, throw printing presses into rivers and shoot editors. Though Lincoln deplored the Alton riot, he also implicitly censured Lovejoy's abolitionist agitation. Both resulted from unbridled passions, which could lead to the overthrow of popular government. Lincoln's reservations about abolitionism extended to other humanitarian reform movements. For instance, he never joined the Prohibition movement, even though he himself didn't use liquor and often spoke at temperance rallies. But he disliked the emotionalism of the prohibitionists, who, he said, addressed drunkards and dram shop keepers in thundering tones of anathema and denunciation, blaming them for all the vice and misery and crime in the land, and condemning them as persons to be shunned by all the good and virtuous as moral pestilences. To the outrage of local clergymen and do-gooders, he announced in an 1842 lecture that if we take habitual drunkards as a class, their heads and their hearts will bear an advantageous comparison with those of any other class. Consequently, he refused to coerce them into temperance, but he enthusiastically backed the Washingtonian Society's program of converting alcoholics by persuasion, kind, unassuming persuasion. In all such matters, what he feared was uncontrolled emotion. Passion, he remarked in the conclusion of his Lyceum lecture, will in future be our enemy. In its stead, the nation must rely on reason, cold, calculating, unimpassioned reason. Only then, he told the Washingtonians, would come the happy day when, all appetites controlled, all passions subdued, mind, all-conquering mind, shall live and move the monarch of the world. Glorious consummation! Hail, fall of fury! Reign of reason, all hail!
This ends Disc 4.